Good evening, everyone. Tonight, as part of our liturgy service, we read a few pieces that point to the practice of living into our values, of taking the fruits of our practice on the cushion into the rest of the world. And part of what enables us to do this is the guidelines for what this might look like take the form of the 16 precepts which we recited, which in addition to taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we vow to cease from evil. Evil is the technical term for all harm-causing actions, all actions motivated by grasping, aversion, and stories of delusive separateness. We vow to practice good, and we vow to save all beings. And then we make several kind of top 10 ways that it turns out that human beings are able to cause harm to themselves and others. Those are called out in the 10 grave precepts, which include taking up the way of not killing, taking up the way of not stealing, not elevating ourselves at the expense of others. Part of our, and we also recited the Gatha of Atonement. We recited the fourfold commitment to racial and social justice, which was a piece that came out of this Sangha's intention to look more closely and respond more vigorously to the harms of the world. Also, and we spent some time as a Sangha looking at ways that we could address issues of privilege and marginalization, address issues of and increase our awareness of issues of racial and social justice. And born of this effort came our Persons of Color sitting group, our LGBTIQ plus sitting group, and another one of our discussion groups, which is called Turning Toward, the subtitle of which is White People Working to Dismantle the Effects of Racism. And in part of this Turning Toward group, we the kind of the purpose of that is for us to, from our positions of some privilege related to race, look at the ways in which we are perpetuating the harms of race, and we are enacting and benefiting by those things, and trying to take up a practice of seeing, of taking responsibility, which is different from taking blame or finding fault, being at one with the realities of those harms, which is the meaning of the word atonement, and trying to respond usefully in the world. And and one thing that emerged from that group, which actually came from something that Mike brought to that discussion group, and he's going to tell us about that, is the land use acknowledgement, which I am going to read to you after Mike says a little bit about how we got to this. So this emerged as a discussion in that group turning toward. We then brought it to the board of directors, who decided that they wanted to take action on that. And this, and I'm going to be telling you about the action that we took in response.
Thank you, Josh. So I grew up in this area, and Eastern Massachusetts strongly connected with pilgrims and the Thanksgiving myth. And that's pretty much what I learned in school, the traditional Thanksgiving myth of the native people coming and greeting the colonists with welcoming arms and help, and then just sort of disappearing. In fact, especially here in Massachusetts, what I did learn was mainly, maybe there was some bad stuff that happened, but it was kind of out west. It wasn't really anything really closely connected with me in the place
Speak
I call
up, please.
In the place I call home. I bought into this mythology strong enough where I really, when it came time when I was an adult to do service, I thought military service would be a good way to do that. So I did that, and this was during the time of Desert Storm, and people were throwing around the phrase "in country" a lot. I didn't even know what it meant. I just thought it meant you were in the country. Turns out it means Indian country. And it comes down from the times when the U.S. Army was invading and colonizing Native American nations throughout this continent. So I was always interested in history, and as I left school, I read more and more. Finally, I came to this book called Indigenous Peoples: History of the United States. And it really turned my perceptions upside down, around, totally turned them over. Their perspective of the people that were here that suffered at the process of colonization, the genocide, the brutal details of that. And particularly, I started learning more about even the history here in Massachusetts. The brutal goings on and leading up to and goings on of what's called King's Philip's War, which was a war fought by the son of Massasoit to try to re-equalize the power between the colonists and the native people in the area, Wampanoag. And there came a day where, and also along with this, for my own karma, is I feel a strong connection to the earth. I really enjoy the outdoors. I feel like this, I've always felt like this was my home, not just the United States, this political entity, but this land itself. And after reading this book and other books and learning more about the details of this history, I was taking a walk just through Boston Common. And suddenly I was almost thrown off my feet. I just was overcome with this feeling of like, this is not my land. This is not my home. This is not exact. This feels almost like I felt like I was in an alternate universe where I was living with the evil empire had taken over. And it was just this moment of waking up, like in my body, of all this stuff that I had learned. And yes, this was a painful, uncomfortable moment for me and the whole process, because this, to me, there's been a sort of a grieving of losing this idea and mythology of what the United States and this history has been. And that is not to put that at the center of things, because to me, that's a valuable, that's been valuable and like long overdue, and not in any way, in any measure, measuring up to the pain that was and it continues to be perpetrated against Native people here. And I really don't know what I would have done, you know, what my next steps would be if I didn't have my Zen practice and this community in particular. Because, you know, this was happening right around the time as a community, we were doing things like forming the piece we read, Full Commitment to Racial and Social Justice. In fact, you might say that probably helped me see these things in the first place. And I knew that there was a place I could go to and talk about this and look for support in doing some sort of action. And having practiced with the precepts and reciting the Gatha of Atonement, these are things that strongly attracted me to this practice to begin with. And when I came to this realization about this history, as much discomfort that was there, it was also like, oh, this is exactly what I've been talking about. Like, there is something that puts this in context, which is these things that Josh was already talking about. Maybe we'll talk about more.
And so when Mike shared this with us in Turning Toward, we all agreed that this was something that we needed to acknowledge and quite literally turn toward. And part of what Dharma practice is increasingly not bullshitting ourselves, increasingly seeing the ways we are complicit in harm causing. All of us always and inevitably implicit in harm causing. This is why we do the Gatha of Atonement, the beginning of every service. And our practice is not to be increasingly sure that we're the good guy, but our practice is to see more and more ways the subtle and also kind of karmically inherited ways that we are continuing to cause harm. And so with discussion in Turning Toward and then with the board of directors, we came up with some language. And this is the plaque that we are going to be hanging right outside the entrance to the Zendo, to call our attention to really the life and death urgency and importance of the practice that we do. And some of this language came from Mike. Mike did some research and was in contact with the Massachusetts Tribal Council, and we asked them what was appropriate language to use. We ran this by them, and yeah, that was part of our process. So this is what the plaque says. It says, the Greater Boston Zen Center sits on ancestral and unceded land of the Massachusetts tribe, the indigenous people from whom the colony and Commonwealth of Massachusetts have taken their names. In the spirit of our practice of continuing atonement for past and ongoing harms from which even this Zen community benefits, we acknowledge the truth of violence and theft perpetuated in the name of this country and make a commitment to naming and sitting amid that truth, bearing ongoing witness to it. Additionally, we acknowledge and offer respect to the Massachusetts tribe, to their ancestral lineage, as well as to their elders and current tribe members who still inhabit historical Massachusetts tribe territories to this day. I'm going to read this middle paragraph again. In the spirit of our practice of continuing atonement, continuing acknowledgement, continuing naming the fact that this is so, being at one with the causes and conditions that brought us here. Continuing atonement for past and ongoing harms from which even this Zen community benefits. This place that we come to practice, this place where we come to turn toward the harms we've cause, the place where we come to remind ourselves of our aspiration to do the least amount of harm possible, the place that we do this is here, is available to us because of harms done to Native Americans, because of the genocide, because of the theft. That's why this space is available to us to rent from our landlord, because it was stolen. And this is a reality. And the fact that it wasn't us personally who did it doesn't mean that it is any less of a truth. And so we bear witness. We acknowledge the truth of violence and theft perpetrated in the name of the country, making a commitment to naming it and sitting amid that truth, bearing ongoing witness to it. The second pure precept that we recite says, bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world, I vow to practice good. This practice of bearing witness is profoundly not nothing. It is not in itself enough, but it is profoundly not nothing. And giving up fixed ideas about ourselves and the universe, fixed ideas of not my fault, not my problem, not my doing. I'm one of the good ones. This is one of the fixed ideas we have to give up if we really vow to cease from evil. And so this plaque will be an encouragement to all of us to really feel the full weight of the karmic debt we take on, even by so excellent a thing as Dharma practice. The karmic debt that we take on, we cannot pay back to the people to whom, from whom it was taken, on whose backs we have built. And so we have to pay it forward in service, in kindness, in bearing witness, in urgent response, urgent actualization of our bodhisattva vows in the relative world. And so this is, and it is, it's This is encouragement for all of us to really challenge ourselves to, in every domain that we can, live into the truth of our values, and live into the aspirations that we express in Larry Yang's aspiration prayer. May I be as loving in this moment as I can, loving towards all beings past and present, alive and killed. If I cannot be loving in this moment, may I be kind. If I cannot be kind, may I be non-judgmental. If I cannot be non-judgmental, may I not cause harm. And if I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least harm possible. The least harm possible through this practice of atonement, turning toward aspiration, bearing witness, giving up fixed ideas. This is our practice. Thank you. So please sit comfortably and be invited into a practice of Dharma dialogue. What comes up for you in relation to any of this or any of the pieces that we read? Resonances or confusions or concerns or wonderings or sharings? Simona.
So, in Nepal, I would consider as someone white would consider here, like privileged. But the moment I landed here, I was minority.
Yeah.
And if someone white would travel from here to the east, then they are not allowed to certain part. Even if it's a tourist place, they won't be allowed to enter those places. Because of the color, they would just naturally assume you are a certain religion and then you are not allowed in some places. But then traveling and then connecting and reading books, traveling through books, so many breakthroughs can happen and then so much we can learn from it. The position changes and then everything turns upside down.
Yeah.
And then it's like it's not nothing that is it. It is some, maybe that's how the nature and the God or something, that's how it balances the thing. When you are something at one space and right the moment you change the place and everything changes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an important point, and part of what you're pointing to there is the truth of what Buddhism calls no self, or no fixed essence of self. All of these things about I am, all of the things that I can finish that statement with, are all circumstantial and causally dependent. And when the causes and conditions change, then those things that I take to be me also change. And this points to the interconnection of oneness and the essencelessness. The no fixed essence of self quality, which is also why this practice of atonement is not a practice of whipping ourselves because I am bad. It is a practice of taking responsibility, acknowledging the truth of interdependent causes and conditions, but also recognizing that all of the harm that we cause from our positions are is also a product of causes and conditions, and is conditioned in that way. And so, and we can see how this changes. We're maybe privileged in some part of our intersectional identity and marginalized in another, where we can see this as being children to our parents and parents to our children, like our identity changes, and including every piece that we define ourselves, even our identity of maybe able-bodied, of able to walk upstairs. Maybe these parts of our identity change too, of intact mind. This may be a way we define ourselves, and this too is of the nature of change. Thank you for taking us there.
Someone is passionate about history, the more I study history, the more I realize I don't know.
Right.
Like, I think about I used to be so afraid of my own ignorance, but now what I'm starting to realize is you have to be okay with what you don't know.
Right.
And the thing about that is, like, for example, I was really interested in Thich Nhat Hanh, not just his teachings, but what he went through in Vietnam. So I read his book, Lotus in the Sea of Fire. And I wasn't left with more answers, but with more refined questions, like, okay, I don't know what it's like to be a Vietnamese peasant as a white guy in America. I don't know what it's like to be exploited by both sides, but I'm open to learning from those people what that experience
right. Is
like. And the thing, and so I think one thing that all these themes bring up is, like, as opposed to being like, okay, it's like there's plenty of people who are causing so much great harm in the world, but we also have to be like, we all have blood on our hands at some point, just
right. Being
and living and consuming, and we're all exploiting things, even we're sometimes even not aware of it.
Right. This is all enormously important stuff that you're pointing to. And when we and you started by recognizing coming to more questions and not knowing. And this is where, when we recite the three grave precepts, the three pure precepts, we say, not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, I vow to cease from harm. Not knowing, recognizing that we don't know, recognizing that the things that arise for us as certainties are not what they claim to be. This is the beginning of our practice. And it's only, and recognizing that the things, you know, we say fire is wet, fire is hot, earth is hard, water is wet, and our mental formations feel true. Our certainties feel true. That's their nature, as much as it is the nature of water to be wet. And being able, and part of what this practice does is help us be able to see mental formations as mental formations and not as the self-existent truths they claim to us to be. And this is the practice of not knowing. And this is also the practice of beginner's mind, which is the scroll that hangs outside the zendo on the other side there, a very important Zen thing. You're also pointing to the way that actually none of us can keep any of the precepts ever. Our lives are built on killing. The act of eating causes destruction. And this is why one of the most intense chants that we do, lengthiest ones, is the ones that we do before meals on retreat practice, reminding ourselves of the responsibility that just the act of eating, the karmic debt we incur from that, however the other things we do as we move through our life. But it's not enough to just throw up our hands and say, you kill people, it's how it goes. But seeing that, really feeling that, really turning toward that, and doing our level best to live into that karmic responsibility, that's what the tools of the tradition are supporting our doing. Thank you for bringing that. Rebecca.
Thank you both. This is so important. My thoughts are half formed, so I'll try to be focused. But growing up in this country as a white person, I've had a disturbingly few amount of times to feel white. And lately, I've just been feeling very aware of being white in the world and like showing up as violence just by being that. And I've also been thinking about, I also am someone who resonates with relationships with nature a lot, like Mike was saying. And the disturbing thing of not only is the land stolen, but we also, I feel there's a relationship from the earth that's also unknown to us and stolen. Like, we don't know how indigenous people in some ways would view the trees. Like, maybe the trees miss them. Like, there's like this relationality that is not just about people stealing something from other people. Like, the earth is also involved in this. So I just thank you for bringing this to the surface.
Dogen talks about the teachings of the Ascension, and you're talking about almost like the longings of the Ascension. Yeah. Thank you, Rebecca. Dan.
So last week, downtown, I saw on the back of a sign, it was a sticker from a neo-Nazi organization that I won't name. And it was a photo of, and it was a drawing of America. And underneath that, it said, not, hashtag, not stolen, conquered, in big letters. And their message was this macho one of Western chauvinism. And I saw the sticker, and after recommending to the building manager that the sticker be taken down, which they worked on, I remembered my old friends, Frank and Sweeney, who I spent a lot of time hanging out with when I was a kid. And they were Mi'kmaq Indians, and they split their time between their grandmother's house in the Fenway area and the reservation up in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I used to get drunk with Frank a lot. And one time he said to me, you know, you Europeans, he didn't use the word Europeans, but he said, you people visited the four horsemen of the apocalypse on us. Death, famine, plague, pestilence. The Indians had been wiped out by the pathogens that the Europeans brought over from the first ships. And then after that, the European armies ran roughshod over the survivors. And he also talked about the plague of alcohol, which we brought over. And I won't note the irony of talking about this when we were very drunk. but Frank also said that he compared it in a striking way to me. He said, consider if in the medieval ages, the Khan brings a plague from Mongolia across Europe, which becomes a Black Death, and say that the Khanate had enough soldiers to sweep over Europe, and then after that introduced this drug to them that wiped out any remaining possible civilizations.
Yeah.
So I hadn't thought about this in a few years, but I maybe serendipitously, I've been reading the book Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick, and he takes a deep dive into King's Philip War, and I was reminded of all these things.
Yeah.
And it's a dark, very violent, bloody, shameful history, and the land we are sitting on is blood red. And I think about this, and not only do people have karma, but civilizations have karma, countries
right.
have karma.
Right.
And I think about that in relation to our practice, where we can't correct past sins. All we as individuals can do, and as societies can do, is atone and vow to behave more responsibly in the future. And
thank you, Dan.
That it's in our palms.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, important. The chant will do at the end of the night. We will vow to save all beings. And this is saving all beings throughout space and time. Backwards and forwards. We can't change the past, but also we can give up fixed ideas of pasts and futures. And part of the reality of essencelessness, of interdependence, of oneness, is that we can practice on behalf of, with, and in fact, as all beings throughout space and time. And this is also not nothing. And so important to, as you're naming here, turn towards the realities. We can't atone for our karma or our inherited karma, our biological karma, our familial karma, our cultural karma, our civilizational karma, until we really investigate it and see what is in fact here. Josh.
Thank you both. I think some kind of thought about like the concept of turning to art, which is one that's been really valuable to me. And sort of the great faith or faith that you talked about in a lot of Dharma talks, and how it feels like there's this element of faith in like having to believe that as you turn towards things over and over and over, that you're not just turning towards your same shitty behavior and it's just going to still be the same behavior, but like it's actually going to turn some kind of like wheel of action at some point. Like, and I feel like that really requires faith, because otherwise it's like, am I just doing this as like a self-soothing like mechanism? It's just, am I just observing my crappy self, and it's just, I'm just always going to be observing the same crappy self?
Yeah.
Maybe I am, I don't know.
So there's some amount of faith and trust that your teachers and the generations of Buddha ancestors aren't just bullshitting you about this practice. But And that's what brings us in the beginning, and then we feel some resonance in our hearts. But then our faith becomes a progressively verified faith. We start to see for ourselves that, you know, we start to see ourselves, you know, maybe just a little bit sooner engaging in some harm, even if we aren't in that moment able to do anything else, you know. And this is why people often think, you know, they come into Dokusan and report, you know, my mind has been such a bigger mess since I started doing Zazen. But actually, your mind has always been this mess. But now that you've started to seeing Zazen, hallelujah, you started to see it. And there is a excruciating point in practice represented by the fourth ox herding picture there, where the ox herder is pulling vigorously against the resisting ox, where we are unable to change our patterns. We can see them so clearly, and it hurts even more to be unable to change them. But this is, you know, one of the things I point out is that that's the fourth stage of these 10 stages, not the zeroth stage. And we see, if you pay attention to your own mind, you know, and I've heard you report these things of seeing, catching yourself, being able to respond, you know, and so you know from your own experience, your faith has become verified faith, that this practice is meaningfully related to your bodhisattva aspirations.
This story for me is a real good example of an instance where my faith has been verified. Like, I could, you know, what were my choices? Just like try to, you know, no, really cling on tighter to the mythology that I always believed in, and therefore like probably cause more harm and feel even less connected to the world around me. There may have been discomfort involved, but like, okay, now there is the world that I'm actually in, and I am connected to, and here's all these people that actually support me in this mm-hmm. practice, and talk about these things on a very fundamental level of how to face this kind of difficulty or awareness.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, everyone.